Good evening, this is Dr. Dan Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is 27 March 2024. We're on chapter number 7 on inflammasomes, and this is my biochemical mosaic number 3. Now, the mitochondrial permeability transition pore is a transmembrane protein, and it resides in the inner mitochondrial membrane. It's typically closed. It's a large protein pore when it does open, and it can be stimulated by mitochondrial matrix calcium accumulation, adenine nucleotide depletion, and increased phosphate or pyrophosphate concentration, also reactive oxygen stress. So, that MPTP, mitochondrial permeability transition pore, opening, and the VDAC oligomerization, remember that's the voltage-gated channel, enable oxymitochondrial DNA leakage to activate the cytosolic NLRP3 inflammasome. That's where we were last time. So oxymitochondrial DNA has to exit the mitochondria, right? For it to reach the cytosol. So the role of this VDAC protein as the voltage-dependent anion channel will resolve to mediate mitochondrial DNA leakage in mitochondrial endonuclease G-deficient fibroblasts. And those cells will exhibit constitutive oxidative stress with a concomitant VDAC oligomerization, which means it's active. Now, in LPS-primed bone marrow-derived macrophages, VDAC oligomerization can be induced by ATP challenge. That indicates the potentiation of channel opening. So VDAC residues in the outer mitochondrial membrane, but where they can reside. But for the mitochondrial DNA to exit via VDAC, it has to pass through the inner mitochondrial membrane, right? So VDAC is on the OMM, but of course mitochondrial DNA is in the mitosol, so it has to first move through the IMM. So remember, that's where the mitochondrial permeability transition pore is located. So that protein has to be involved in mitochondrial release through that inner membrane. And once that entire release occurs into the cytoplasm, you will then obtain C-gas sting activation fibroblasts. And they're going to overexpress a protein called TDP43, which is associated with a very significant pro-inflammatory disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. So that's where this was first worked out, in ALS. Now, it doesn't surprise me that ATP challenge induces the MPTP opening, and that MPTP inhibitor known as cyclosporin A that binds to cyclophilin D, which mediates calcium-stimulated MPT opening, would all be regulated by this ATP challenge. Okay. So other experiments with inhibitors for all these different proteins involved in the response suggest that MPTP opening precedes VDAC oligomerization. And then that, of course, is essential for oxymitochondrial DNA leakage to the cytosol and induction of the inflammasome. Although mitochondrial DNA oxidation was initially suggested to trigger its leakage, the mitochondrial OGG1 overexpression, remember that's the glycosylase enzyme, the repair enzyme, BER enzyme, or ablation, doesn't have any effect on VDAC oligomerization or on the opening of that MPTP. That suggests that mitochondrial channel opening is not directly coupled to the production of the substrate, which of course is mitochondrial DNA oxidation. Okay? The product of that will be the oxomitochondrial DNA. So overall, VDAC oligomerization opening don't appear to require mitochondrial DNA. So all of the processes that are involved in that for translocating ultimately that product in the cytoplasm, inducing the inflammasome, function without having that oxymitochondrial DNA present. So that means the induction is there, obviously more of as a canonical control over inflammasome induction from a mitochondrial source event. Okay, so that means the mitochondria have emerged as central regulators of inflammation. We know this. Think about apoptosis as well, right? Mitochondria and the NLRP3 inflammasome intersect in multiple locations. We've been talking about this for the last several lectures. Once you get cytosolic mitochondrial DNA containing non-oxidized and oxidized bases, so a mixture, they will activate the cGAS STING pathway, which, unlike the NLRP3 itself, since it's strict to, doesn't have any preference for the oxyDNA, because it evolved to provide protection from all types of foreign nucleic acid, DNA in particular. Remember, it's functioning as a toll-like receptor, right? Only it's associated with the inflammasome. So oxymitochondrial DNA generation precedes NLRP3 inflammasome assembly. Mitochondrial DNA oxidation, of course, has two distinct functions then if we want to trigger them out. One is when you get oxidized mitochondrial DNA, you'll get fragmentation. That can generate a specific NLRP3 ligand, which will induce the inflammasome. So the earliest molecular event in the pathway is actually a mitochondrial calcium uniporter. It's called an MCU. So you have MCU-dependent calcium uptake, and that occurs quickly after a stress stimulus. The calcium divalent cation will trigger MPTP opening in the IMM to induce the OMM VDAC oligomerization. Concurrently, then, the NLRP3 activators trigger mitochondrial reactive oxygen synthesis, which is further enhanced by mitochondrial depolarization of that membrane, intermembrane, due to the MPTP and VDAC opening. So you're going to get excessive amount of oxidation of mitochondrial DNA because you're going to have excessive amount of ROS, reactive oxygen species. And that, of course, is also the prerequisite for fragmentation of the DNA. So the oxymitochondrial DNA generated in that pathway can be repaired by the BER enzyme, the 8-oxoguanine glycosylase, the OTG1. And, of course, when that occurs, it will attenuate the NLRP3 inflammasome and the cGAS STING activation. Okay? So now you get more detail than you had before, but we're still showing you the multiple routes to regulate the inflammasome. So mitochondrial DNA escaping stressed mitochondria promote inflammation, and they do so through the GAS STING pathway, cGAS STING pathway activation. Okay, so you have to have that oxymitochondrial DNA binding to the cytosolic NLRP3. So what we're saying is that there are diverse NLRP3 inflammasome activators, and they can be rapidly stimulated by uniporter-mediated calcium uptake into the mitochondria, because that's going to open up the MPTP, trigger the VDAC oligomerization, and that will still occur independently of whether or not you have mitochondrial DNA that is yet to become oxidized. But within the mitochondria, oxymitochondrial DNA will either be faithfully repaired, because that can still occur, by the OTG1, because it's a DNA glycosylase, repair enzyme, basically just a repair enzyme. Or it can be cleaved ultimately by this enzyme known as FEN1. It happens to be an endonuclease, mitochondrial endonuclease. It'll cut up that mitochondrial DNA into 500 to 650 base pair frags that will exit the mitochondria via that MPTP VDAC dependent channel, and that will initiate cytosolic NLRP3 inflammasome activation. Okay. So now you've got that entire process worked out. Now let's go back up, up like to say 14,000 some odd feet on the top of Pikes Peak. It's what I can normally describe rather than talking about being an airplane. I've been on the top of Pikes Peak several times. I can tell you, you can see quite a bit of the geography of the entire Intermountain region, as well as the flatlands leading to Kansas and going out to eastern Colorado. So that's a better meme for me when I think about when you're up at a high enough level to observe all this entire mosaic. Okay. Now, inflammation is, of course, innate immune response. What is it supposed to be doing? It's supposed to protect the body from microbial infection and then all kinds of stress, primarily oxidizing stress, right? So the inflammatory response relies on pattern recognition receptors by recognizing a variety of PAMPs and DAMPs. Remember, the PAMPs are pathogen-associated molecular patterns, and the DAMPs are danger-associated molecular patterns from the host. And they work through receptor-ligand interactions, of course. So the inflammatory response has two steps: priming, triggering. We talked about this in the very first lecture in this mosaic. Priming is the preparatory step in the inflammatory response and involves inducing of the transcription of all the players in the pro-inflammation response, right? All the gene products. It occurs via the cell surface and the endosomal PRRs. What are some of the endosomal PRRs? TLRs, toll-like receptors. They're going to activate NF-kappa-B, that's the nuclear factor kappa-B, activator protein 1, AP1, and that's going to turn on the IFN regulatory factors, that's interferon regulatory factors, or IRFs. All of that is just the very first stage of priming. Triggering is the activation step of the inflammatory response. That involves the activation of inflammasomes that we've been spending a lot of time on. Intercellular protein complexes have to form, like the NLRP3, and they're going to comprise a component of the PRRs, remember, because they're going to be acting like a receptor. The NLRP3 acts like a receptor, like the toll-like receptor. Remember, it's molecular organization. Remember the leucine-rich repeats and all that. And, okay, so that's why that's called a nucleotide binding oligomerization domain, a NOD domain. And then the NOD domain-like receptor is the NLR. And the P stands for protein, and you get the rest of it. And the AIM2, which is another important protein here, if I haven't told you already, that's named rather sadly absent in melanoma 2. And then you have, of course, the inflammatory caspases, and we've talked about those. The inflammasome activation is the key feature of the triggering step of all the subsequent downstream responses. And then if you get dysregulation of the inflammasome a posteriori to the triggering, that will be a major risk factor for chronic inflammatory and sometimes auto-inflammatory human disease. Okay? So post-translational modifications are going to play a role here. They're going to be critical for innate immunity and all the inflammation we've been talking about. Those PTMs will occur on components of the inflammasomes. They're going to regulate the activity and function of those inflammasomes. What's a major PTM? Methylation. Now we're going to talk about the epigenetic component here, finally. Methylation is, of course, the process where a methyl group, CH3 group, is added to a polypeptide or a nucleic acid or a lipid, right? Or even a carbohydrate, and that will lead to what we call epigenetic modifications of all of those methylated products. And they will have functions that are required for cellular homeostasis via methylation, and also an alteration of cellular homeostasis if there is demethylation inappropriately on both sides of that axis of valency. So any change in methylation status will have profound biological effects, and many of these biological effects are received or obtained in human disease presentation. And these include inflammatory responses and associated diseases. So methylated proteins, including trimethylated histones, we've talked about very often about, and that's a predominant substrate for the protein methyltransferases. And whether the two amino acids, whether all, most often occurs on those histones, lysines and arginines. But you also have DNA methyltransferases, DNMTs. We've talked about these in the past as well. They methylate DNA typically at the CpG methylation islands, and the cytosine residues, remember, of CpG islands that form a domain within a region that becomes a methylome. Typically, that's in a promoter region or enhancer region of a gene responsible for many biological functions, including those associated with human diseases. So obviously, if you get a dysregulation of DNA methylation, that's going to also be a major risk factor for altering directly gene expression. Aberrant gene expression can generate human disease, obviously. So these methyltransferases will catalyze the methylation of DNA, polypeptide, as we said, such as histones, other proteins, and also phospholipids. Okay, so these, all of this methylation is one capacity of modulation of biological activity in the eventome of an epigenetically modified system, which is not rare, but which is common in all of biochemical processes. We used to think it was a relatively rare event when we first discovered the epigenetic signatures. Now I'm telling you, this is common for normal activity, all based on the biochemical framework, right? All on that biochemical ontological event that occurs to generate the physiological association of life. Okay. All right. Now you know that there are a lot of different kinds of inflammasomes. We've been talking about them, you know, off and on, right? So recall that there are multiple inflammasomes, and they're named after their pattern recognition receptors, because that will promote their ultimate assembly. So all of these pattern recognition receptors are distinguished by specific structure. The structure has to do with sequence. So those proteins will be assembled in the inflammasome, and they will recognize different types of PRR-specific PAMPs and DAMPs, right? That's where the recognition occurs, right? So the inflammasomes can be classified into two main groups, canonical and non-canonical. The canonical ones include all those NLR family, pyrin, and AIM2 inflammasomes. The non-canonical inflammasomes include unusual cast bases, such as isoforms 11, 4, 5, and then their associated inflammasomes. Okay, so the cast bases themselves will impart some of that pattern recognition, obviously, because that's going to be downstream processing, for nothing else, for all those pro-inflammatory cytokines. Right? So the NLR family of PRRs are subclassified into five different subfamilies. They are NLR, A, B, C, P, and X. And there are 14 different NLRP and 5 NLRC subfamily members. But only some of those subfamily members are demonstrated to form intact platform inflammasomes that can activate inflammasome-induced inflammatory responses. Those other proteins, we're not sure what they're doing, because there's quite a large family, right? Those NOD proteins that are associated with this complex. So NLRP1, the most complex structure, and that comprises an N-terminal PYD, the nucleotide binding and oligomerization domain that collectively is called the NACT. Yeah, those leucine-rich repeats I talked about, the LRRs. Then you have functional to find domain. That's called the FIND. Then you have a carboxy terminal cast base. Recruitment domain, you know, that's the CARB. And unlike human NLRP1, three isoforms of NLRP1 have been shown in the murine model. Okay, so there is a distinction. When we use murine model to bootstrap and extrapolate up to the human studies, you have to remember that there is a lot of differential organization of these inflammasomes between the mouse and the human. Who's surprised at that, right? No one. So that provides a different mechanism entirely on inflammasome assembly with the ASC component, because now you're going to get different assemblies between the human and mouse because of the association of all the NLRs with the ASCs. Okay, that's going to give you ultimately much more florid subdivisions of NLRP inflammasomes between the murine and the human. And I'm not going to go into all the detail, but there's a lot to be said about zinc fingers, B boxes, coiled coils, etc. Sometime we can tear all this apart, but there's a great deal of protein chemistry involved in the ultimate NLRP3 inflammasome complexes between the murine and the human. And they do perform differently in their triggering and in their activation. Now, the PRRs recognize different types of PAMPs and DAMPs, as we've said, okay? And those are going to be inside the cells, and they're going to have a specific sequelae when those PAMPs and DAMPs are recognized by those PRRs. So you have post-sensing of ligands by those PRRs, the NLR family, the pyrins, the AIM2s, etc., which are all going to assemble into canonical inflammasomes with procaspase 1 and with or without ASC, as you've been informed. Okay. Now, DNMTs catalyze DNA methylation, obviously. That's going to play a great number of roles that we've been talking about. Here's some significant aspects in the inflammasome association for these epigenetic phenomena. DNMT3B, well known in a glycolic acid-mediated anti-inflammatory response, occurs by inhibiting the expression of inflammasome complex genes, transcriptional level, in human keratinocytes and in HACAT cells. And that demonstrates that while the expression of NLRP3, NLRC4, AIM2, and ASC genes was decreased by glycolic acid treatment, the glycolic acid increased the protein expression activity of the DNMT3B, right? DNA methyltransfer 3B. That resulted in a hypermethylation of the promoters of two of those genes, the NLRC4 and the ASC. That results in a downregulation and expression of those genes in those cell lines. That might suggest that the DN methyltransferase 3B plays an anti-inflammatory role, controlling the inflammasome-induced inflammatory response. It does so by inhibiting the expression because of methylation, epigenetic signature therein, of some of the inflammasome complex genes that we just went through. The NLRP3 inflammasome activation is also regulated by DNMTs, and that was shown in a Mycobacterium tuberculosis-infected human monocyte cell line called THP1. The NLRP3 promoter activity was decreased, once again, by the methyltransferase the methyltransferase inducing the methylation of the promoter. That led to the downregulation of the NLRP3 expression, while the expression of the promoter methylation by DNMT inhibitor upregulated the expression of NLRP3 in those THP1 cells, which are, again, the Mycobacterium tuberculosis-associated human, or infected, I should say, human monocytes, okay? All right. Chemotherapeutic induced DNA damage by global methylation and silencing of DNA damage repair genes and hemorrhagic cystitis obtains an inflammatory and ulcerative bladder condition. Systemic treatment with chemotherapeutics like cyclophosphamide, CPX, facilitates the accumulation of DNA damage by downregulating expression of DNA damage repair gene OGG1, and an induced subsequent NLRP3 inflammasome activated pyrotosis of bladder muscle cells in this murine model that where the study was conducted. So DNMT1 and DNMT3B methylates the promoter of the OGG1 gene, leading to OGG1 silencing and then the induction of the NLRP3 inflammasome activated inflammatory response. See? Methylation control there. And in fact, inhibition of OGG1 by inhibition of OGG silencing by DNA demethylation suppresses the NLRP3 inflammasome activation and, of course, all the downstream induced inflammatory responses, such as pyrotosis and interleukin 1 beta secretion in the bladder muscle. So all of this form fits pretty well. The methylation seems to be controlling at a very stark level the inflammasome activation. Let me check my time here. Wow, we're really close to the end. Okay, I will have to finish this next lecture, but I will tell you one more. There's a disease called the Kawasaki disease that causes swelling and inflammation in the walls of the small to medium-sized blood vessels that, of course, carry blood everywhere in the body. And the Kawasaki disease most often affects the heart arteries in young children. So it's a very, very tragic disease. Those arteries, of course, supply the oxygen-rich blood to the heart, right? So Kawasaki disease, which is also known as the mucocutaneous lymph node syndrome, causes, as the name suggests, swelling in glands, including lymph nodes, and the mucous membranes inside the mouth, nose, eyes, and throat. So children with Kawasaki disease generally have high fever, swollen hands and feet with skin peeling, red eyes and tongue. However, Kawasaki disease can be treated, and with early treatment, most children get better and don't demonstrate or obtain any long-lasting sequelae from the disease. So that's a good thing. Now, in patients with KD, Kawasaki disease, the expression of NLR family PRRs, such as NLRC4 and NLRP12, and pro-inflammatory cytokine interleukin 1 beta are all increased. But the methylation levels of the CpG islands of those genes is depressed, particularly in the white blood cells of KD patients. When you compare them to normal subjects, what does that indicate? Hypomethylation of the genes of the inflammasome PRRs, those two proteins, the C4 and the P12, and indeed the pro-inflammatory cytokine interleukin 1 beta, obviously are playing the regulatory role in the upregulation expression of these genes, resulting in the induction of the inflammatory response and all the pathogenesis associated with KD. So once again now, you see where you're having a control over a suppression of the inflammasome that's linked, it's going to be linked directly to methyltransferase activity. Okay. So I'm going to leave you with that introduction of the Kawasaki disease and the fact that it's controlled by methylation. And next time, if we have time tomorrow's Thursday, the 28th of March, to finish what I thought I could get done today. The reason I say that is because we're getting into a period in the Roman Catholic Church, which is going to be the 3 days that center around the end of Lent, okay? And during that time, it's called the Paschal Triduum. I try not to do much work, and that includes authentic biochemistry. So I'm not sure if I'll be able to do a lecture until Sunday, Easter Sunday night. Okay, that depends on whether or not we can work in a lecture tomorrow, Holy Thursday in the morning. If I can, I will do it. Otherwise, you won't hear from me again until Sunday, Easter Sunday evening, the 31st of March. This is Dr. Dan Guerra. Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. wishing you a good evening, and bye for now.